Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. Sebastian Woodruff was 41 years old when he traveled from British Columbia to the Peruvian Amazon seeking spiritual healing through ayahuasca. But things did not go as planned because on April 19th, 2018, he shot and killed 81-year-old shaman Olivia Arevalo Lomas. Although his motive for the killing is largely unclear, village locals lynched him in a vigilante-style killing, and that video was later posted on Facebook. But what really happened that day? And why did two people end up dead in the middle of the Amazon? When most people think of Peru, they likely picture Machu Picchu, the iconic ancient ruins, stunning natural landscapes like the Amazon forest, the Nazca lines, and the Colca Canyon. This week, we're traveling deep into the Amazon rainforest to a tiny village outside of the city of Pucallpa, which holds more than 200,000 people and sprawls from the banks of the Ucayali River into the surrounding rainforest. The area is home to a number of indigenous people, including the Shipibo Kononibo, who have lived in the rainforest for centuries. They are marginalized and poor, and have been in conflict with powerful oil, mining, and logging people who have stripped away much of the rainforest and polluted the waterways. The city is known for ecological tourism and cultural tourism, like shamanism, which is a spiritual practice that involves using altered states of consciousness to connect with the spirit world. A shaman is a religious specialist who uses their connection with spirits to heal, guide the dead, and protect their communities. Shamans are revered members of their community and may also act as spiritual ministers, dream interpreters, and elder statesmen. They use a variety of techniques to alter their state of consciousness, like trance, drums, singing, and plant medicine. The village of Victoria Gracia is an hour rickshaw ride away from Pucallpa, consisting of 100 or so wooden houses on a dusty flatland. On all sides are monkey brush and coconut and palm trees. There's no running water or electricity mains, and the women spend their time making and decorating clay pots. But the community isn't totally free of modern influence. Most of the villagers dress in Western clothes, own generators and cell phones, and they follow European soccer teams. This area of Peru is mainly popular with a certain type of tourist, those looking to partake in ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is a dark tea derived from mixing a leaf and a vine. The leaf, Psychotria viridis, contains dimethyltryptamine, or DMT. If it's taken by itself, the leaf does nothing because the enzymes in the stomach neutralize the DMT. But the Shipibo people figured out hundreds of years ago that when the leaf is boiled down with the ayahuasca vine, it blocks those stomach enzymes and creates a potent psychedelic brew. Ayahuasca tourists have been arriving from North America and Europe since at least the 1960s and have long been accused of appropriating and dishonoring indigenous tribal culture by using the brew, which is an important part of religious ceremonies, for recreation. The recent boom in ayahuasca-seeking outsiders is in large part to scientists' speculations that DMT, which is illegal in the US and Canada, might help treat addiction, depression, post-traumatic stress, and other disorders. But studies on this go both ways. Some saying that ayahuasca can decrease activity in the brain's so-called default mode network, alleviating apprehension and anxiety and inspiring introspection. But other studies have indicated that DMT can also aggravate pre-existing mental illnesses, like bipolar disorder. Because of the popularity of possible benefits, hundreds of shaman schools and ayahuasca retreats, many run by North American and European expats, have popped up. They promise to cure all kinds of ailments while providing a mind-expanding experience. And these retreats are extremely profitable. One of the largest is in Iquitos, Peru's largest jungle city, and it brings in nearly $6 million annually, charging guests as much as $2,700 for a week's stay. Supporters of the drug claim that the ayahuasca boom has helped to revive tribal culture and injected much-needed revenue into indigenous communities. But most locals disagree. They feel that ayahuasca tourism has become an industry churning out a product for wealthy foreigners who have turned the medicine into a recreational party drug. And because of the new demand, the price of ayahuasca has risen from about $10 a session to 10 times that and more. The number of pseudo-shamans has risen too. It takes years to actually become a shaman. It requires patience and deep knowledge of plants and herbal remedies. Fake shamans have no idea what they're doing and see ayahuasca as a business opportunity. And they often mix ayahuasca with other more volatile plants to create a more explosive trip for the tourists. The ayahuasca trip can last 3 to 4 hours. Participants drink the tea, usually throw up, and then lie on mats in the dark and fall into a dreamlike state. The shamans will chant and sing while the effects hit. People who have taken ayahuasca say the visions can be intense and life-altering, often calling up past traumas buried deep in the subconscious. Top retreats focus on healing their guests, offering experienced, trusted shamans, comfortable rooms, and assistance on hand to help guests should their trip take a bad turn. But shady pseudo-shamans don't know how to help their guests if something goes wrong. Participants have been robbed and molested and can become violent or sick, and some have even died. Over the past decade, at least 11 tourists have been killed in incidents linked to ayahuasca in Peru. Kyle Nolan was an 18-year-old American who, in 2012, was secretly buried by a shaman after he died in an ayahuasca ceremony. In December 2015, during a ceremony at a retreat in Iquitos, a British man started waving around a kitchen knife and screaming until a Canadian man, also on ayahuasca, managed to grab the blade and then stabbed the man to death. There have been so many crazy ayahuasca-related deaths of tourists that I'll likely be doing several more episodes to cover some of them. Ayahuasca by itself normally cannot harm you. It's like a scanner that allows the shaman to find out exactly what's wrong with his patient. You'll throw up and feel a little trippy for a few hours and hope for a life-changing experience, but that's about it. On the other hand, if ayahuasca is mixed with alcohol, recreational drugs, or certain medicines, it can invite a variety of other problems. There's a link to the combination of antidepressants and ayahuasca to an illness called serotonin syndrome, which begins with shivering and palpitations and can lead to seizures and death. Also, the stress of traveling, especially in a foreign country like Peru, can result in a negative experience and even trigger violent reactions. Many people who have taken ayahuasca claim that the experience led to positive, long-term, life-altering changes. It's said to amplify introspection and problem-solving related to past and current life stressors, and for powerful envisioning and strategizing of solutions for a more hopeful future. But the downside is that it can be unsafe. Ayahuasca contains chemicals that can cause hallucinations, tremors, dilated pupils, increased blood pressure, nausea, vomiting, as well as life-threatening side effects and death. I've researched both sides of ayahuasca, and I'd say it's not something I want to try. I probably would have tried it in my 20s, and I'm honestly a little surprised I didn't. But these days, the last thing I want to do is a drug that makes me hallucinate. But Sebastian Woodruff was all about ayahuasca. He had done it multiple times and felt it was pointing him in the right direction in life. He wanted to learn more about it and study its effects so he could use it to help other people. Let's get to know Sebastian and how he ended up in Peru with an ayahuasca obsession after a word from our sponsors. Sebastian Woodruff was born on October 26, 1976, in Barrie, Ontario. From a young age, he was a prankster who took pleasure in getting friends out of their comfort zones. Whether by climbing mountains barefoot or getting lost in the woods, he wanted people around him to experience what he felt were amazing things. He was friendly and popular, the kind of guy who, on short walks to the store, would repeatedly get stopped by friends to chat. In his early teens, he spent a lot of time in the forest near his home on Vancouver Island. He could identify most plants and knew which ones were edible and which were poisonous. He loved the outdoors, learning survival techniques, and had a general calling to nature. As an adult, Sebastian never had much direction in terms of a career. He drifted between jobs in construction, tree planting, and sea urchin diving. He was a bit of a lost soul, and the guys he worked with on the boats nicknamed him Sea Bass because he was distant and wrapped up in his own world most of the time. In his early 30s, he had a son, but his relationship with the child's mother didn't last. And this was really hard on Sebastian because he felt like she was the one that got away. He did remain a committed father, but never really embraced traditional family structures and was never entirely comfortable with the typical expectations of how a man should act or behave. He wasn't out there trying to be a macho man. He was more of a dreamer and a pacifist. He had a lot of ideas, but rarely had any motivation to implement them. The time he spent with his son was often in the woods teaching him survival tips and how to recognize different species of plants and what they were used for. He had a video blog called The Sacred Circle, talking about the outdoors and his knowledge of plants. He would say, "Get your shoes on, go out in the woods, and talk to the plants, talk to the birds." His love for the outdoors complemented his strong spiritual side, and he became more interested in indigenous North American cultures. He even participated in the annual Sun Dance ceremony, a brutal ritual of physical punishment and fasting. It usually takes place over 3 to 4 days in a Sun Dance lodge, where dancers dance around a pole that has a bison skull at the top. They dance in shifts, stepping to the beat of a drum and saying prayers. In one part of the dance, participants will tether themselves to a pole by piercing a hook through their chest as a sacrifice to the community. And Sebastian loved to show his friends those scars. Rituals like this, along with teaching his young son about nature, gave Sebastian purpose. But above all, he wanted to improve the lives of people close to him with the things he was learning. He cared little about material things. For him, having oneness with nature, not money or social acclaim, was the key to happiness and well-being. He had a strong philosophy that went against mainstream lifestyle by opposing consumerism, materialism, and technology. In 2013, Sebastian's life changed when his family staged an intervention for one of his relatives who had been struggling with alcoholism. He began to think deeply about addiction and suffering. He said in his blog, "The drink problem comes not from the drink itself, but from the family. There are so many unresolved issues, so much trauma. It's as if the spirit of our family has been hurt." And he wanted to be the one to heal those wounds for people. He decided to become an addiction counselor. Writing online, "Never before has a path been so clearly laid out for me." As he pursued his new career, he remained committed to his free-spirited nature, showing little interest in Western medicine for addiction. He felt that modern treatments worked for only 5 to 8% of people, saying it was a rather dismal outlook for those working in and hoping to receive help from these programs. He believed old ways of thinking were preventing alternative methods, like plant-based medicines, from playing a larger role in treatment. He wanted to integrate knowledge and healing from other parts of the world to help bring these numbers up. One of the remedies he had in mind was ayahuasca. He heard about the drug through his brother-in-law, who had tried it at a ceremony in Whistler, British Columbia. After doing some research, he felt bringing it to others was the best way he could help them. In late 2013, he launched a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo to help bankroll his career change as an addiction counselor focused on plant-based medicine. He wrote that he had an opportunity to study for 3 months with a plant healer in Iquitos, Peru, saying the man came from a long line of healers going far back into the mists of time. The healer allegedly had more than 40 years of experience using native plants' potent capacity for healing. Sebastian thought he needed to go there to learn how it could be used successfully in the treatment of people with addictions. His goal was to raise $10,000. $6,800 to stay at the healing center, $2,000 for travel, and $600 for a Spanish translator. He was only able to raise $2,261, but that didn't stop him. In September 2014, he traveled to the Peruvian jungle city of Iquitos to study under ayahuasca shaman Guillermo Arévalo. After that first trip, Guillermo said Sebastian was a good person, although one struggling with trauma. But there was nothing unusual about that, because most people that came to him for ayahuasca were struggling. For Sebastian, that first interaction with ayahuasca only pushed his desire to learn more about it. Over the next 3 years, he made several more trips to Peru and continued to take ayahuasca in ceremonies near his hometown. But he also seemed to become more disillusioned with life, and his friends said he could be distant and erratic at times. In his Facebook posts in 2016 and 2017, he professed to feeling lonely and low and wanting to be with friends. Some of his friends thought he was struggling from a recent breakup, while others thought that his quest to become a healer and his trips to Peru were causing him problems and creating a disconnect between his fantasies of becoming a spiritual healer and the everyday grind of life. Friends said that Sebastian was charming and essentially a good person. But beneath the surface, he had a temper and could be volatile and obsessive. If he thought he was right about something, he wasn't one to back down. People that knew him felt that ayahuasca changed him. He started dieting constantly, not consuming salts or sugars, and lost a considerable amount of weight. People noticed a change in Sebastian, and his father, Gary, even advised him to seek professional help, but that only made him withdraw from people even further. Continuing to drink ayahuasca, along with his decline in mental health, was a disaster waiting to happen. The other victim in this episode is Olivia Arévalo Lomas. She was born in February of 1937. At 81 years old, she was a small, frail elder with a childlike demeanor and was a very powerful curandero and shaman. A curandero focuses on the practical application of healing through herbs and rituals, while a shaman focuses on direct spiritual interaction with the spirit realm to heal. She was a grandmother figure to the villagers of Victoria Gracia and a spiritual matriarch to the Shipibo Conanipo people, one of the largest tribes in the Peruvian Amazon, with 20,000 members concentrated around the Ucayali River. She was the descendant of a long line of healers. She knew over 500 herbal remedies and was, to the younger villagers, one of the last links to their dying tribal culture. Fellow villager Nestor Castro said, "She had the power to calm storms and strong winds." She had become one of the most renowned and recognizable shamans in Peru, as she often used ayahuasca in her ceremonies. Members of her family were also shamans and had established many of the ayahuasca retreats that Olivia worked at through the years. Because some were aimed at tourists, she was well known in the Western world as well. People would travel from all over the world to be part of her ceremonies. She was full of kindness and light, and she would giggle and laugh all the time. She was well-loved and adored by her family and her community. She had so much knowledge about plant medicine that she was considered a walking encyclopedia by everyone around her. The village treated her with respect and affection. She was also an outspoken advocate for human rights and environmental protection. She advocated for the recognition of indigenous communities' rights and the preservation of their ancestral territories. She truly used her life to help everyone around her, including the environment she lived in. How did the lives of these two people from completely different worlds end so tragically together? We'll cover the timeline and the facts in this case after a word from our sponsors. Sebastian had participated in numerous ayahuasca ceremonies in both Peru and British Columbia. But in September of 2017, going back to Peru, he was more desperate to feel better than ever before. He wrote on Facebook that he was going this time to study under local shamans to fix his mind. But things didn't go as planned, and shortly after he got there, he reached out to the owners of the fishing company he had previously worked for in British Columbia and asked for a loan. He said that his passport and wallet had been stolen, and he was hoping his former employers would loan him several thousand dollars. Sebastian claiming that his passport was stolen was a recurring theme during his time in Peru. He made that claim numerous times while he was there. The owners refused to give him a loan, and by the end of the month, he ended up back in BC at work on the fishing boats. But he was only there long enough to get money to head back to Peru. He arrived in Lima on December 15th, still determined to become a healer. Almost immediately, he ran into problems. He again reported that his passport was stolen. Then, he was involved in a collision in Lima while driving a rental car. While waiting with the other driver for police to arrive, the two were using an online translator on their phones to communicate. The other driver later said that during the translation, Sebastian asked where he could get a gun. The man thought the translator had interpreted incorrectly or that he'd misunderstood, so he responded by saying he didn't know, and Sebastian told him not to worry about it. But guys, this is a giant red flag. Sebastian soon left Lima, but instead of going to Iquitos, as he had in past trips, he traveled to Pucallpa, where he rented a room. It was here that he met Nelly Vasquez, one of Olivia's granddaughters, and he begged for an introduction to the famous shaman. Nelly was hesitant to work with him because he seemed strange and frantic, but he told her that another relative, Guillermo Arivalo, had sent him, so she eventually agreed to introduce him to her grandmother. When he first arrived in Victoria Gracia, he arrived with a local taxi driver named Herbert who translated for him because he didn't speak Spanish. He was very pushy with Olivia, telling her he wanted to do ayahuasca with her right away, saying he was sick. He asked whether her powers could reach as far as Vancouver to cure his whole family, and she assured him they could. But she wouldn't do ayahuasca with him because he wasn't in the right frame of mind and had not gone through the proper dieting required for the ceremony. Over the next month, Sebastian returned to Victoria Gracia numerous times, usually causing problems. They said he was constantly coming around, sometimes during the day, sometimes during the night. A villager remembered him turning up in the village at midnight intoxicated, brandishing a club that he used to threaten Olivia's friends. He was always drinking the village beer and was out of control. Villagers called him Pele Cara, or Face Peeler, and Pishtaco, or Boogeyman. As his behavior became increasingly troubling, they told him not to return, but he didn't listen. They said they reported him to police on at least two occasions and even detained him, but the authorities did nothing. It's hard to determine Sebastian's frame of mind during this time in Peru, other than the accounts from the villagers. It's impossible to know how much ayahuasca he was taking or whether he was taking any other drugs. His instability could have come from his mental health or a combination of outside influences. Although his autopsy reports were inconclusive as to whether he had ayahuasca in his system at the time of his death. Sometimes when he came to the village, he would visit with Julian Arevalo, Olivia's son. Investigators believed that the men may have had some sort of business relationship, perhaps involving their starting an ayahuasca retreat together. But things soured as Sebastian became increasingly more volatile. During Christmas and New Year's, Sebastian didn't reach out to his family at all, and they were worried about him. On January 3rd, 2018, they wrote on his Facebook wall, "Gotta ask, does anyone know where Sebastian could be? Family cares and has no idea. Please message me if you do. Thanks." 2 days later, Sebastian wrote only 3 words, "I am alive." But things were going downhill fast for Sebastian in Peru, and his relationship with the Arevalo family was ruined. Olivia was not going to teach him anything or do ayahuasca with him, and they didn't want him in the village at all anymore. There were rumors that Sebastian gave Julian money, either for ayahuasca ceremonies that he never received, or that he had been ripped off after giving Julian thousands of Peruvian soles to buy land to start a new retreat. But the rumors were never confirmed, and Sebastian never had that kind of cash to give. Sebastian left Peru on January 12th and traveled back to British Columbia. At home, he was living out of his RV, seemingly lost and confused about what to do next. In February 2018, he wrote on Facebook, looking for a job, house, basically a life. A few days later, he wrote, "I miss my family, friends, and feel like shit. I hope I'm not sick." He was consumed by internal conflict and was spending most of his time isolated and alone. At the beginning of March 2018, he wrote on Facebook, "Who's going to Peru? I have lots of Peruvian money to sell," which made it seem like he was done going there. But a few days later, on March 11th, there was a change of heart, and he wrote on Facebook, "I'm off to the jungle to do some soul searching and fix the mind. See you when I'm healed. Fuck my life, part 4. His friends and family questioned his decision to go back because they thought his mental health was an issue and tried to talk him out of it, but he wouldn't listen. On March 14th, Sebastian was back in Pucallpa, but he wasn't staying at the retreat. He was staying in a low-rent room he found in the hamlets around the city. On March 27th, he wrote on Facebook, "I'm feeling better day by day in Peru. So thankful to be sitting with good peeps." But also added that he was leaving the place he was at due to tribal disagreement. Behind the scenes, his life was spiraling into something dramatic and frantic. He was paranoid and in total darkness about the apparent decline in his mental health. In late March 2018, Sebastian turned up at an ayahuasca center near Pucallpa looking for Julian, but the shamans asked him to leave. Then, on the morning of March 30th, Sebastian wandered into a police station near the center of Pucallpa asking to buy a gun. This was obviously strange, because it was by no means a normal way of buying a firearm in Peru. But according to local newspapers, he had been trying for months to get a hold of a gun, so it seems the police were his last resort. And shockingly, it worked. Using Google Translate, he told an officer that he was going into the jungle and needed protection from animals. The officer agreed to the sale because, as he said, the gringo was offering such a high price, it was worth it. On April 3rd, 2018, Sebastian returned to the police station and paid about 3,000 soles, or about $900, for a silver Brazilian-made Taurus handgun. The purchase was strange and unusual, but not illegal. People who know Sebastian couldn't believe he wanted a gun. He was never interested in firearms, never had guns at home, and never talked about guns at all. So him getting a gun was totally out of character. His friends and family doubted he even knew how to use one. On April 5th, he wrote on Facebook, "Not enjoying life right now, having a rough go, please send me prayers." The next time he turned up was on April 10th, looking for Olivia, but the villagers again turned him away. On April 14th, he went to the police after drinking beer and said he had been accosted and robbed by 2 men dressed as police officers who stole his backpack. another story about his passport getting stolen. But on Facebook, he had a different tune, saying, "Coming home soon and need a place to call home. PM friends if you know of anything." And again 2 days later writing, "Still looking for a place to live in Courtney. Love my own place, but open to a roommate. I cook." The day before Olivia's murder, he turned up again in Victoria Gracia, holding a sign written in Spanish that said Julian owed him 14,000 soles, which is about $4,000. Although his family said he would have never loaned anyone that much money, even if he had it. On April 19, 2018, Sebastian spent the morning alone in his rented room. On his desk was the book, The Happiness Equation, and three orange prescription bottles, sleeping pills, Klonopin for panic and anxiety, and olanzapine, which is an antipsychotic. Also in his room was a long hunting knife, a wrestling mask, and that handgun. At 10:30 a.m., he was speeding through the rainforest on a red motorbike he borrowed, following a dirt road cut through the trees. He pulled into Victoria Gracia at noon, stopping in the middle of the houses, taking his helmet off, and throwing his bike down. He started yelling Julian's name over and over, and when Julian appeared at the window, Sebastian fired the gun. Julian ran out the back of the house, but Olivia lived in an adjacent house, and when she heard the commotion, she went out her back door to investigate what was going on. At the same time, the villagers spotted Sebastian and ran toward him shouting. He turned to escape, but by now, Olivia was blocking his way. He panicked and fired once, then again. Olivia fell to the ground, and Sebastian scrambled back to his bike and tried to start the engine. But the switch was tricky. The villagers closed in. Finally, he got it started and sped off, but hit a dip in the road and lost control, and they were able to surround him. Some villagers wanted to take him to the police, but the requests were ignored. While Olivia lay dying underneath the trees being held by her granddaughter, the villagers murdered Sebastian in retaliation. And although they didn't trust the authorities, someone called them. After a while, the police from the nearby city of Pucallpa arrived. They surveyed the scene and collected evidence while the villagers grieved for Olivia. They told authorities that it was a man named Sebastian Woodruff, that he had come in and killed her, but he got away and they had no idea where he was. The next day, they made a poster that was circulated online with the words "Si Busca," which is Spanish for wanted, in bold caps at the top of the page. And below were two photos of Sebastian. It said, "This is the man who killed our teacher, Olivia Arevalo, after making her sing an Icaro. He found her alone, asked her to sing, and then killed her. This happened in the colony of Victoria Gracia, Ucayali, Peru." In South American indigenous culture, an Icaro is a healing chant. If it's sung by a shaman, it's said the Icaro channels medicinal spirits. But of course, that's not what happened at all. The poster was meant to be misleading, so people thought Sebastian was on the run. It was meant to distract police from the fact he was murdered by the mob just minutes after shooting Olivia. And this was all discovered just 2 days later, because someone in the village recorded it on their cell phone and sold it to the local Peruvian media outlet. It was posted on Facebook on April 21st, 2018. In the grainy cell phone video, Sebastian is struggling to stand. He's dressed in jean shorts and a black sweatshirt. He's lying in a puddle, clearly in pain, moaning and gurgling in the blood and dirt. He's incoherently pleading for his life. It seems clear that he's on the brink of death. Around him, there's a crowd, but no one is stepping in to save him. The villagers, maybe 25 of them, mostly men, scream, "Why did you kill her, you son of a bitch?" They yell in indigenous languages. Others stand under the thatch awning of a shack, saying nothing. School children walk through the area. A man in a baseball hat then tries to loop a seatbelt around Sebastian's neck, but he's able to throw it off him the first time. The man tries again and gets the noose tight around Sebastian's throat. Someone shouts, "Pull, pull," and the man does. He and a partner drag Sebastian into the grass, and he's lying face down with his arms at his side and is no longer struggling. The man holding the end of the noose drops it. Then Sebastian lifts his head, and the man snatches the noose and pulls it tight again and again. Then the video cuts off. It is one of the most disturbing and cruel videos I've ever seen, and I wouldn't advise watching it. It's not something that I'll be able to get out of my head for a long time, and I really hope his family and friends never saw it. Once authorities saw the video, they went to the village and they found his body. He was wrapped in a blue sheet and had been buried in a 2-foot grave. His face was swollen, his body was purple with bruises, and his clothes were covered in dirt and dried blood. After his body was found, forensic experts determined that Sebastian did murder Olivia, like the villagers said. Officers discovered his silver Taurus handgun buried in a nearby cemetery, and they matched the empty cartridges found near Olivia's body. Gunshot residue was also discovered on the sleeves of Sebastian's sweatshirt. The autopsy confirmed that Sebastian died by strangulation after receiving several blows across his body. Ronald Suarez, the highest authority of the Shibibo Kananibo tribe, said Sebastian's killers acted in the spur of the moment and resorted to traditional justice. He said, "We are a peaceful people who have always lived in harmony with nature, but we have little confidence in the police as, so often, crimes against us go unpunished." Because Olivia's death follows a list of unsolved murders of indigenous activists who are bombarded with death threats for protecting their land. There are several different accounts of what happened, but the only thing we know for sure is what we saw on the video. And we definitely don't have a solid motive. But stay tuned for a few theories. We know the basics in this case of who killed who. But there are a few discrepancies, and we don't know the motives. First is the murder of Olivia Arevalo. While I agree that Sebastian killed her, his friends and family disagree. They said he'd never do something like that and just wasn't someone who could take a life. At the same time, they said he had a temper and was doing hallucinogenic drugs, and they were worried about his mental health. And guys, anyone is capable of murder. The fact is, he bought a gun, brought it with him, and had gun residue on him. Also, there were multiple witnesses in the village. This was the center of town, in the middle of the day. Many people saw him shoot her. Could the police have made up the story about him buying the gun, planted the gun, and fabricated the gun residue? Could the villagers have lied or been mistaken about what they saw? Yes, it's possible, but not probable. There are too many clues pointing in Sebastian's direction on this. The real question is why he shot her. From witness accounts, I don't think he went there with the intention of shooting her. I think she startled him and he was scared, likely on drugs, wasn't used to handling a gun, she was in his way, and he panicked. Some people think Sebastian and Julian had some kind of business dealings going on that went sour. They said Sebastian claimed Julian owed him thousands of dollars, which sounds like a plausible theory. Except Sebastian didn't have much money. He was asking for donations on crowdfunding and loans from his previous employers just to get by. Another theory was that he wanted Olivia to do ayahuasca with him, but when she refused, he shot her. To shoot and kill the person you want information from isn't logical because you'll never get the information from a dead person. But it doesn't seem like Sebastian was using logic that day, so it's possible. The theory I think is most likely is that Sebastian was experiencing some kind of mental break and had strayed from reality due to drugs, drinking, mental health, or a combination of all three. We may never know, but I think Olivia's murder was ultimately an accident. After he shot Olivia, we had videos of the villagers lynching him. So we know exactly how he died and who did it. It was a crime of rage and passion. They watched their beloved elder get murdered, and once they caught him, things got out of control. There were at least 25 people watching, and no one stepped in. And guys, this is mind-boggling to me. There are several psychological and social reasons why a crowd might not help or even videotape a violent crime rather than intervene, because this isn't the first time we've seen something like this. The bystander effect is a phenomenon that occurs when people are less likely to offer help in an emergency when others are present. The assumption is that someone else will intervene, leading each individual to take less responsibility. The more people present, the less personal responsibility each person feels. Similar to the bystander effect is the diffusion of responsibility, deferring to the tendency for people in a crowd to believe that someone else is better suited or more responsible for taking action. With so many people present, each person may think someone will do something, which leads to no one taking action. I think social influence and conformity plays a big role in this case. These villagers were family. They all knew each other, looked up to each other, were in the same tribe and small town. In situations where people are unsure of what to do, they look to others for cues on how to behave. If no one else is stepping in, individuals might interpret that as a signal that intervening is not the right action. This can create a kind of group paralysis where everyone follows the inaction of the others. One of the main men in the video was the town leader. Who is going to stop the town leader? People might have also hesitated to intervene due to fear of becoming a target of the violence themselves. They may have thought that helping could put them in danger, or going against the men and elders of their community would have repercussions later on. Witnessing a violent crime is shocking. Many people freeze in response to extreme situations. Their beloved grandmother was laying under a tree dying, and the mob was lynching the man who did it. I'd say that's a very extreme situation. In large crowds, people sometimes lose their sense of individuality and moral responsibility. They might behave in ways they might not if they were alone. This can make people feel anonymous, which may lower their inhibitions and reduce the sense of personal accountability. And then we have to take into account that this is a different culture and way of life from what most of us know. They're used to solving their own problems and don't rely on the police or authorities, who are at least an hour away through the jungle to the nearest town. They may have felt this was the only way they were going to get justice. I'm definitely not trying to defend what they did. Just giving some theories on how it might have happened and how all those people stood by and let it happen. It's obvious that they knew what they did was wrong because they not only hid his body, they even made wanted posters of him so people would look for him. And they might have gotten away with it if it hadn't been for the video, which was sold to the media. Remember, this is a very poor community. The direct prosecutor in the case named four of the men in the video as perpetrators and two as the murderers, and issued a warrant for their arrest. Unfortunately, they weren't apprehended because they went deeper into hiding in the jungle under the protection of the Shipibo communities. When, or if, they are caught, they will face between 15 to 35 years for aggravated murder. Despite the media attention these murders received, interest in ayahuasca and going to the Amazon to use it has shown no signs of slowing down. Most people who use the drug do so with good intentions and respect the indigenous culture. But there are still problems, and there are still people who don't return home. And those who don't return home rarely get justice. Should you travel to Peru or any foreign country to participate in psychedelic tourism or spiritual tourism? Meaning, should you book your next vacay around an ayahuasca trip? It's a risk I'm not willing to take. Psychedelic tourism involves traveling to use substances like ayahuasca, peyote, or psychedelic mushrooms, often in a setting that offers a culturally or spiritually guided experience. With the goal to have a transformative or mind-altering experience, it's a type of travel aimed at achieving personal growth, self-discovery, or spiritual enlightenment. And while ayahuasca has been known to produce amazing effects in people, the problem is that it can have very negative effects as well. The physical effects include throwing up, lots of diarrhea, increased heart rate and blood pressure, which can be especially risky for people with pre-existing heart conditions or hypertension. People may get dizzy, have tremors, or loss of physical coordination. In rare cases, ayahuasca can provoke seizures and ultimately death. The psychological issues can be pretty bad as well. If someone who is not fully prepared for ayahuasca takes it, it can worsen the issues it's supposed to be helping. People looking for the healing effects are often suffering from some form of mental health issue, but it's not recommended for people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or other psychotic conditions, because it can trigger more symptoms like paranoia or delusions. Also, for some people, the experience can be so intense that it leaves them feeling emotionally shaken or distressed, especially if they've confronted traumatic memories without proper support. One of the biggest problems is that ayahuasca has very dangerous reactions with other drugs, especially antidepressants, which many people are taking. Sebastian was taking several medications, including sleeping pills, anxiety meds, and an antipsychotic. Plus, he was known to drink alcohol regularly. He never should have taken ayahuasca. Now, just because it's not for me, I'm not against using plant medicine, and it could be for you. So here are some tips if you plan to travel to Peru to partake in the ceremonies. First, research the retreat center or shaman very carefully. Verify their credentials. Look for centers with positive reviews and testimonials from previous participants. Reliable sources like travel forums, ayahuasca-focused communities, and independent review sites will be your best resource. Word-of-mouth recommendations from people you trust who have had positive experiences with a specific retreat center will be invaluable. A reputable retreat should have clear protocols for managing both the physical and psychological safety of participants. This includes having trained facilitators or assistants present during the ceremony. Also, do your own research and know what to expect. Familiarize yourself with the ceremonial structure, including how long the ceremonies typically last, the role of the shaman, and the type of support available before, during, and after the experience. Learn how to prepare your body and listen to the shaman. They will tell you about the ayahuasca diet. Don't try to cut corners on this because they use this diet to help you stay healthy. It typically involves avoiding certain foods, alcohol, caffeine, pork, salt, spicy foods, and sex for at least a week ahead of time. Reflect on why you want to do ayahuasca and what you hope to gain from the experience. Set a clear intention to help you stay focused and make sense of the insights that might come through. Also, before going, consult with your doctor or a healthcare professional. Make sure you're not taking anything that will interact with the ayahuasca, and look out for pre-existing conditions that could worsen by participating. Talk to your doctor about your mental health and reasons for doing this to make sure it's the right direction for you. Once you're there, trust your gut. If something feels off about the retreat center or the shaman, it's okay to back out. Your safety and comfort are the most important considerations. If this decision is for you, be sure to enter the experience with an open heart, but keep your boundaries. Don't hesitate to ask questions, assert your needs, or express any concerns. You have a right to feel safe and respected throughout the experience. And my last piece of advice is not to do something like this on a solo trip. Go with a friend, family member, or loved one. Bring someone that can and will advocate for you. And as always, make sure that no matter where you're traveling, you inform someone about your plans before going anywhere. Tell someone reliable where you're going, what you'll be doing, and when to expect you back. And my number one tip to staying alive on vacation is to pay attention to your gut. If something doesn't feel right, it isn't. On April 19th, 2018, two murders took place in the Peruvian jungle. Olivia Arevalo was senselessly shot twice by Sebastian Woodruff, who was then lynched by a raging mob. There is no justice in this case, and there never will be, because two lives were lost due to a collection of bad decisions. The idea of ultimate enlightenment from drinking some tea sounds amazing, but it's just not how this works. Certain medications and plants can begin a healing process in people, but there is no wonder drug out there that can change your life in an instant. Only persistence and hard work can do that. If you see someone struggling with their mental health, speak up. And if you witness a crime, step in to stop it. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.